JC Corcoran Podcast.
Thank you. I'm a modern man. I'm a modern man, a man for the millennium. Digital and smoke-free. A diversified, multicultural, postmodern deconstructionist, politically, anatomically, and ecologically incorrect. I've been uplinked and downloaded. I've been inputted and outsourced. I know the upside of downsizing. I know the downside of upgrading. I'm a high-tech lowlife, a cutting-edge, state-of-the-art, bi-coastal multitasker, and I can give you a gigabyte in a nanosecond. I'm new wave, but I'm old school, and my inner child is outward bound. I'm a hot-wired, heat-seeking, warm-hearted, cool customer, voice-activated and biodegradable. I interface with my database is in cyberspace, so I'm interactive, I'm hyperactive, and from time to time, I'm radioactive. Behind the eight ball, ahead of the curve, riding the wave, dodging the bullet, pushing the envelope. I'm on point, on task, on message, and off drugs. I got no need for coke and speed. I got no urge to binge and purge. I'm in the moment, on the edge, over the top, but under the radar. A high concept, low profile, medium range ballistic missionary. A streetwise smart bomb. A top gun bottom feeder. I wear power ties, I tell power lies, I take power naps, I run victory laps. I'm a totally ongoing Bigfoot slam dunk rainmaker with a proactive outreach. A raging workaholic. A working rageaholic. Out of rehab and in denial. I got a personal trainer, a personal shopper, a personal assistant, and a personal agenda. You can't shut me up. You can't dumb me down, because I'm tireless and I'm wireless. I'm an alpha male on beta blockers. I'm a non-believer and an overachiever, laid back but fashion forward. Up front, down home, low rent, high maintenance. Supersized, long-lasting, high-definition, fast-acting, oven-ready and built to last. I'm a hands-on, foot-loose, knee-jerk head case, prematurely post-traumatic, and I have a love child who sends me hate mail. But I'm feeling, I'm caring, I'm healing, I'm sharing. A supportive, bonding, nurturing primary caregiver. My output is down, but my income is up. I take a short position on the long bond, and my revenue stream has its own cash flow. I read junk mail, I eat junk food, I buy junk bonds, I watch trash sports. I'm gender-specific, capital-intensive, user-friendly, and lactose-intolerant. I like rough sex. I like tough love. I use the F word in my email, and the software on my hard drive is hardcore, no soft porn. I bought a microwave at a mini mall. I bought a minivan at a megastore. I eat fast food in the slow lane. I'm toll-free, bite-sized, ready-to-wear, and I come in all sizes. A fully equipped, factory-authorized, hospital-tested, clinically proven, scientifically formulated medical miracle. I've been pre-washed, pre-cooked, pre-heated, pre-screened, pre-approved, pre-packaged, post-dated, freeze-dried, double-wrapped, vacuum-packed, and I have an unlimited broadband capacity. I'm a rude dude, but I'm the real deal. Lean and mean, cocked, locked, and ready to rock. Rough, tough, and hard to bluff. I take it slow, I go with the flow, I ride with the tide, I got glide in my stride. Driving and moving, sailing and spinning, jiving and grooving, wailing and winning. I don't snooze, so I don't lose. I keep the pedal to the metal and the rubber on the road. I party hardy, and lunchtime is crunch time. I'm hanging in, there ain't no doubt, and I'm hanging tough, over and out.
Hey, no, I'm just getting warmed up.
Happy to see you again.
Don't be nervous, don't be rocky. You're a teenage guest disc jockey now.
Did that voice inside you say, I've heard it all before? It's like deja vu all over again.
You think America is the best country in the world? Disabled people in the Netherlands get money from the government up to 12 times a year to spend on prostitutes. And with that, we say good morning to the JC Corcoran podcast for the 22nd of April, 2021. I would be so afraid to go to a prostitute that I would not be able to, shall we say, perform. I'd just be scared. I'd be scared that it was an entrapment, you know. You walk in, you drop your pants, and then a bunch of guys from the FBI come running in from an adjacent room. Or there's this issue of disease. And then also, you know, like, what guarantee do you have that you're going to be physically attracted to the woman that they send to you. You know, a lot of strippers are like that too. Everything is fine. You'll come walking in, you'll look up there and you're like, wow, what is she doing in a place like this? She's too pretty. And then at some point she smiles. You see her teeth going off in about 17 different directions. And you're like, okay, now I get it. We've gotten off to a bizarre start today, haven't we? Okay. I have a real treat for you later on in the podcast. I'm still, you know, trying to decide as we go here because we've been doing this a couple of weeks now. And I'm still trying to decide based on what I think and what you think and what some people that are in the industry, shall we say, that have been listening and say, why don't you do this? Or, oh, you really should do more of this. Or why don't you drop this? I'm like, okay, okay. So I'm taking all this stuff into consideration. But what people seem to like, as long as it doesn't go too long, on the, more than 10 minutes, and then people start getting bored. But they like the celebrity interviews, particularly the musicians. We had Don McLean in two parts earlier this week. So today we're going to have our conversation with Todd Rundgren. Todd Rundgren is somebody I've always admired. I mean, first of all, you got to like this guy, you know, playing all of the instruments himself in a lot of his albums. Like his songs, the melodies. There's a lot of humanity to the music of Todd Rundgren. And it was a couple of years ago, he was playing the Peabody. We had him on the air. It's a fascinating conversation. Again, it's one thing I always tell people because I get asked about this a lot in interviews. It's one thing to get access to a big star or somebody who is a giant in the music industry. And I've been, you know, harping on this whole thing about Todd Rundgren not being in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It's ridiculous. He should have been in 30 years ago. He's still waiting for his turn. So this is really one of these things that's stuck in my craw. But as I was saying, it's one thing to get somebody to do your show. It's another thing to have them say something interesting or funny or have a genuine feel to the interview that's entertaining. In other words, not only are you getting the information, but he's telling the story in a funny way and you guys are having an exchange and we really hit it off. So Todd Rundgren coming up in the tail end of the podcast today. This is the sixth anniversary of the Bridgeton Tornado or Tornadoes. I still remember we were at a wine bar out on Clarkson. It was sort of at the front end of technology with regard to being able to get weather information and radar on your cell phone. Now, I'm saying 6 years ago, and that doesn't seem right. Maybe it's just I had an old phone. All I know is I'm sitting there drinking wine, and I keep looking at this radar thing, and it's like, this is not right. This thing is big. There's two of them. There were two heading towards the St. Louis area, towards West County, and they were getting bigger, and you were getting these bright colors, you know, the yellows and the oranges and the reds and the intense reds. And I know enough about this stuff to know this is bad news. And where we were, Clarkson, a little bit south of 40, was a little too close for comfort as I saw this thing bearing down. And we now know that the Bridgeton Tornadoes, in addition to beating up the airport, Dave Murray was live on Channel 2, and at one point he got under the desk. And I've been in that building. I used to work over there. And let's just say it's not built for the purpose of withstanding a direct hit from a tornado. So he was definitely doing the right thing. I think there's some people who thought that he was overly sensationalizing things. He was not. He was not. I would have gotten under the freaking table, too. And by the time it was all over, you know what happened. All of that 6 years ago today. Don't look now. Matt Carpenter, your St. Louis Cardinals, hitting 079. We're almost a month into the season. And this is the anniversary of another event in my life, in my career, that I wish had not happened. So the people from Cystic Fibrosis come to me and they say, we have this idea. There's going to be a Cardinal baseball game on a Friday night. And what we'd like to do is set you up in front of the hotel, the old Clarion, which is only a block and a half away from the ballpark. And we like to do this thing called Brats on the Lot. And what we would do is we would set you up there prior to a Friday night Cardinal baseball game. You go on the air like 4 or 5 in the afternoon. And we invite people to come by and have a free bratwurst on their way into the ballpark. And then we'll hand them a little flyer about cystic fibrosis, raising awareness. And maybe at some point these people will feel compelled to donate a little money, whatever the case may be. Would you be interested in doing that? I said, sure, no problem. So sure enough, Friday night, beautiful evening. And we set up out there in front of the old Clarion. And we're doing the show. And I had a wireless mic, so I was able to go, you know, pretty much anywhere. And I loved going across the street to Stadium Garage East. I was just interviewing people coming in and out of the ballpark, just asking them silly questions. You know, all this boneheaded stuff that radio people do when you're live in a situation like that. And I'm standing there talking to, like, one of the garage attendants or something, just messing with them. And around the corner comes a small group of people, maybe a dozen or so. And you can just tell they're up to something, but I'm just watching this out of the corner of my eye while I'm live on the air interviewing this guy from Stadium Garage East. And all of a sudden, one of the people from this group of about a dozen starts like waving his arms and stuff and his hands in my face. And I thought he was going to punch me in the head. So I raised up my arm I collided with his, and then he goes down like he's been shot. And he's laying on the ground on the street, basically, the sidewalk right there. And he starts doing these WWE convulsive moves. Like he's laying there and he's convulsing. And people are standing around and some of them are laughing. And I'm like, what the hell is going on here? And so I just skedaddled right across the street and back over to the lawn in the hotel there where we were doing the show. A couple of minutes later, again, from around that corner, Stadium Garage East, comes another group of people, and I recognize one of them as one of our competitors on the radio. And again, I'm just across the street from him, and he holds up a cell phone way up in the air, and then very ceremoniously dials three numbers. 911. You guess it, the police show up, and they try to arrest me, saying that I assaulted this guy in the crowd. Well, as you probably figured out by now, the whole thing was a setup. That resulted in a lawsuit that I filed. A couple of years later, when it finally did come to trial, a six-day trial, by the way, and I was awarded $370,000 by the jury. That was 1994, and I know a lot of you, from what you've told me, would still like to get this little punk in a corner in an alley somewhere, but we don't do that, do we? Because we're civilized. And now this.
What's up, guys?
Hey.
If I gave you this Bud Light, are you up for whatever happens next?
Yeah, sure. Wait, do I have to drink the Bud Light?
Yeah.
Oh, then no.
What? Why?
Because Bud Light tastes like a beer that someone already threw up.
Yeah, it's like a liquid John Mayer song.
Okay, but the thing is, like, it's all about whatever happens next, so if you could...
Yeah, but it tastes like the flat soda that a homeless guy uses to rinse off birds.
Yeah, that's exactly what it tastes like. Yeah.
Okay, look, I'm not supposed to do this, but we have hidden cameras inside of this bar, and when you get outside, there's, like, going to be this huge thing for you if you could just drink this Bud Light.
You mean the beer that tastes like water strained from a gutter full of dog's teeth?
Bud Light tastes like the scared urine of a rabbit.
It's like Steven Seagal's pre-company.
Yeah, but we have like an epic night plan for you.
Okay, listen to me very, very carefully. This is important. If a nickel could urinate, it would taste like Bud Light.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Bud Light tastes like the ghost of a dead lemon.
Basically, if water could just go bad.
We have a stretch limo waiting for you guys outside with Peyton Manning in it, and he's going to take you to play a game of giant Jenga, okay? And then after that, you're going to go on one of those Virgin Galactic missions into space.
That sounds amazing. I'm just not going to do it.
All right, you know what? Just let me drink it.
Okay, what does that taste like? Describe it.
It tastes like if a raccoon ejaculated carbonated vinegar inside of an old log.
That is good. Really nice.
Bud Light, the only beer that makes you up for literally anything else.
2 years ago, as far as hockey was concerned, it was the season that just kept on giving. So many great stories, sidebars, little human interest stories, led by Layla Anderson, who turns 13 years old today. Here's a kid that didn't even know if she was going to be able to live much longer. And here she is, healthy and 13 years old and still the semi-quasi-official mascot of your St. Louis Blues. And that story went national in so many different places and was told in so many different ways. And you're going to live a long, long time before you're ever involved in a local story like Layla Anderson. And we wish her the best on birthday number 13 today. And Layla shares that birthday with Peter Frampton, turned 71 today, John Waters. And I had the opportunity to interview him back in, 1990-something, when he did this movie called Cry Baby. And it was shot, as all of his movies, in Baltimore. I got to go there. And also, that was the trip where I got to interview Tracy Lords, because she was in that movie, too. Johnny Depp was in that movie. Got a chance to interview him. Tracy Lords, by the way, when I asked her about the porn career, she said she didn't remember any of it because she was on drugs the whole time. Ain't buying it, Tracy. Jack Nicholson, 84 today. Let me tell you this story. I love this. I love this. I was a big fan of the TV show Green Acres. I still am. I think it's like Me TV or something runs it from time to time. And I will sit there and I just still laugh at Green Acres. It's just the funniest thing ever. Of course, the star of the show, Eddie Albert. Now, Eddie Albert died in 2005. Prior to that time, I don't know where he actually lived. I only know that he played Sybil Shepherd's father in the movie The Heartbreak Kid, opposite Charles Grodin. This was the original Heartbreak Kid. This was the good one. Ben Stiller did a remake of it a couple of years back, and it sucked. But the original Heartbreak Kid, if you can get your hands on it, is just fantastic. And Eddie Albert played the father of Sybil Shepherd in that movie. And if you know the movie, you know that eventually the scene shifts back to Minnesota. And I don't want to give anything more away just in case you haven't seen it. But go rent that movie because it's fantastic. So, and I had interviewed Eddie Albert before, but it was only on the phone. And the reason, this is a dumb story. So I used to work in Omaha, Nebraska, and they had this thing in Omaha called Exarban, which, you know, give them points for being clever out there in Nebraska. Exarban is Nebraska spelled backwards. And Exarban was this sort of like state fair type fairgrounds thing. And they have shows in there. And once a year, they had the big Exarban Festival. And they were bringing in Arnold Ziffel, Arnold the Pig. This was the slayer. He had appearing at Exarban this year. Arnold Ziffel. And everybody knew it wasn't really Arnold. The TV show was made back in the 1960s. What are the chances that when I'm on the air in Omaha, Nebraska in 1980, that the pig is still alive? So we know. It's like Lassie, you know, like six or seven of them. So we are in Minneapolis in the Cardinals Hotel for the World Series in 1987. We're sitting there doing the show, and walking right past our table is Eddie Albert. And I'm thinking to myself, no, my mind is playing tricks on me. Eddie Albert was in The Heartbreak Kid, and his scenes were shot in Minnesota, but he doesn't live here. Why would Eddie Albert be here? But it's obviously him. And he walks by. I go to commercial break and I go after him. Oh, please, Mr. Albert, such big fans. We're doing the show back to St. Louis. Can you just come by our town? Oh, I don't think so. I don't think so. I don't think so. Oh, damn. In about 10 minutes, he must have thought it over or something. And he just walks back over to the table and sits down. And now we're interviewing Eddie Albert. But he was telling me stories about Arnold the pig. Because I said, you know, every time Arnold would come into the house, he'd run over to the TV, turn it on, and there would be like, you know, a Western type movie on. And he would sit down and watch it. And it's like, how'd you get the pig to walk over there and look like he was turning on the TV? And they said, well, the pig wrangler had a little clicker. And when he would click the clicker, he had a piece of candy on the knob of the TV. And so when he heard the clicker, the pig knew to run over to the TV and chew the little piece of candy off of the knob on the TV. And they had another pig backstage that then turned the TV on to make it look like he had turned the TV on. But he also told me a story about, and I saw this episode, maybe 6 or 7 years ago when I was watching Green Acres. It was a scene where they had, it must have been 100 or 200 baby chicks in a room. And Eddie Albert was supposed to be walking through this room, but these baby chicks all over the place. And unbelievably, he copped to the whole thing about that he had stepped on and probably killed some of the baby chicks. This is apparently before they had that disclaimer that you see at the end of television and movies where they say no animals were injured in the making of this show. Apparently, they didn't have that back in the 60s when they were making Green Acres. What a great guy. Died in 2005. He was born on this date in 1906.
Hello, it's me.
I have been such a fan of this guy going all the way back to his first couple of songs that I heard on the radio. Hello, it's me. Can we still be friends? I saw the light. Open my eyes with Naz. Bang on the drum. Plays all of the instruments and writes songs that just have something special about them, some sort of special quality. So I guess this was about 3-4 years ago, and Todd was coming into St. Louis to play the Peabody, and we had a chance to interview him. This is great stuff, folks. Enjoy.
We're talking with Todd Rundgren. I want to go back to before the beginning, not just some kid who saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan and threw together a garage band and said, I think it would be fun to do this. I'm talking about when you really got serious about this and said to yourself, you know what? I really think I could do this. I think I want to make my living doing this stuff. Take me back to those days, Todd.
Well, it sounds very proactive, like I made that kind of decision, but it was more like by the time I got out of high school, I was unqualified to do anything else. I didn't have the grades to get into college. I hadn't really developed any other skill. I didn't take auto shop when I was in high school. All I had was essentially my guitar and, you know, whatever it is I could get out of the guitar. And I kind of got lucky because it didn't take me too long to get into a working band. And from that point on, it was just, you know, climbing up the ladder. That band was called Woody's Truck Stop in Philadelphia. We were like a typical white blues band modeled after Paul Butterfield. And I didn't sing and I didn't write. All I did was play so-called blues guitar. And then the whole music scene changed, and the band decided that they wanted to be the Grateful Dead and go to the country and take acid and get their heads together, as they like to refer to it. And that's when I formed my own band called The Naz. That's probably when I got more serious, because I realized I had to write stuff, and I was singing backgrounds and stuff for the band. I didn't sing a lot of leads or anything, but that's when I started to really sort of expand as a musician outside of just playing guitar.
And one of the reasons I've always been drawn to you, and I think that explains a lot of your fan base, is that you're a boat rocker. I mean, you never just want to do anything normal or straight. You always want to put the Todd Rundgren twist on things. What was it about the music industry and what you were hearing coming out of the radio? And if you were in Philadelphia, you were getting a little better brand of radio than most people got across the country. So you were getting a little taste of a lot of different things that were out there. But what was it that, were you just dissatisfied? Did you find pop music just sort of boring? Or just sort of take me back to the mindset in those days.
Well, all of us got our inspiration from the Beatles. You know, the Beatles were an eclectic band. They started out covering other people's songs, and then they started to write their own material. And then, you know, after they started getting high and stuff, coming up with really weird hybrid of music, you know, once they got mentally liberated. And so growing up with that, you sort of figured that music is supposed to be evolutionary, you know, it's supposed to change all the time. You're supposed to pay homage to your influences, all whatever variety they may be. And the Beatles were a great repository of that, because they do anything from like old trad rock and sort of bluesy stuff to English music hall to inventing, you know, whole new genres like psychedelic rock. So I grew up believing that that's what a real musician did. They kept absorbing influences, resynthesizing them, and you never did the same thing twice.
And this is very interesting, because while we're talking about the production aspect and just sort of the wild influences, still about 90% of Todd Rundgren's music really has an ever-presence of humanity in it. You know, things that all human beings should probably be concerned with. Love and friendship and looking for answers in life. So I guess there were that Beatles influences. When it came right down to it, they were writing about people.
Well, yeah, the Beatles succeeded because they were ultimately relatable. They started out with extremely simple but identifiable themes like, I want to hold your hand. You know, something as simple and direct as that. And then they get to, like, you know, A Day in the Life, which is just like an epic, like some sort of epic mural painting or something like that. So they were always relatable in that sense. And unless you're like really kind of cynical about it, or you do it just because it's a job, it's always a reflection of your personal experience. I've always wanted to know about things, not simply read about them, but go out and experience them. So my music is a reflection of combination of my curiosity and the experiences I have relating to other people, but also trying to figure myself out. A lot of people sort of figure when they get out of school, that's when you stop learning and you just kind of utilize what you've learned for the rest of your life. But I've always actually learned more when I got out of school than I ever learned in school. And the music simply is kind of a document that reflects the stuff that I've learned.
Man, oh man, if I could high-five you on that one. You sound like you're crawling around inside my head, by the way, but that's maybe a conversation well, for another day.
It's funny how common my experience growing up in the 60s and 70s and stuff like that is with a lot of my peers. You know, we were all kind of rethinking everything. The world that we suddenly found ourselves in that seemed to be constantly at war, and the women's revolution and the black struggle and the drugs and all of that stuff. A lot of people my generation, that was a generation of great upheaval and change, and we all kind of identified with it in a way.
Well, let's tap into that right there, because I've had similar conversations with a couple of guys like that, most notably Graham Nash. In the 1960s, you know, you had all these people running around in tie-dye and gauze shirts and bell-bottoms, and their hair was long, and everybody was rebellious, and that was the 60s, and now a good chunk of that population, they're all the ones listening to Rush Limbaugh and voted for Donald Trump. And not to get political about it, but what the hell happened? Because those people were supposed to change the world. We were going to change the world as kids. And instead, an alarming percentage of those people really did turn into their parents.
Well, you could look at, you know, these trends for a vast amount of the population as being just that, fads that they go through. You know, all the peace and love and all of that stuff. It's easier when you're young and you don't have kids of your own that you have to set an example for. A lot of that, you know, just settling down to a regular life sobers people up a bit. I've been fortunate because I never had to get a regular job, you know, because I actually had two jobs. I had record production as well as being a working musician. The record production always guaranteed me a good income, so I was always much more free in terms of making my music. And I think that that's, you know, what happens to a lot of people, that just the realities of trying to survive economically and adapt to the change that is constantly happening. You know, sometimes people just give up and they say, okay, I'm just going to go with the flow. Now, having said that, without getting too political about it, I don't understand anybody who votes for Donald Trump. I don't want to sound like I'm identifying, because I'm definitely not. But I think people's so-called political beliefs proceed from how they see the world, and they try and find a politic that somehow adapts to that. And we just naturally, when we get older, get more insular and a little bit more selfish and protective and clannish and that sort of thing. It's a survival mechanism, I guess. And you have to sort of consciously resist it in a way. Dare I say, part of the appeal of my music is that it is constantly pushing against convention and trying to look at things in a different way or reevaluate things in a different light, just so you understand them a little bit better. It doesn't mean that people actually change just because they've had the revelation. Yeah. They can realize, you know, oh, geez, you know, what a mistake I've made, and I shouldn't be living this way. But it's too late to change. Yeah. So you just wind up continuing the old habits.
Like when you talk to baseball managers here in St. Louis, I had long conversations with Tony La Russa when he was managing the Cardinals. And he's like, this isn't about managing baseball. It's about managing people. So when you're working with Badfinger or Grand Funk or Meatloaf and producing all of this fabulous music for other people, is that applicable to the music business too, where you're not really managing music, you're managing people?
Well, you could say the producers have different approaches to what they do. Like when I first started out, I didn't really understand how much of like psychology and politics is involved and trying to get a project done. The musician's predicament may seem unique, but people always feel pressure in their job, and you don't realize that part of your job is to relieve that pressure, just to simply make them feel comfortable and not distracted and to focus on what they're trying to accomplish. When I first started production, I didn't realize that that's what it was. I thought it was all sound. You know, you make everything sound great and you tell the band how they should play and that sort of thing. You know, that's what George Martin would have done. But George Martin didn't become the fifth Beatle without constantly trying to understand what it is they wanted and make it as easy as possible for them to get it. And so in latter years, I started to realize that, yeah, it's more about kind of managing the personalities involved. Yeah, you may be making a musical or technical contribution, but you're not trying to put your imprint on it. Whoever's name is on the front cover, they're the ones that have to live with the end result.
Yeah. You know?
Nobody says, you know, like, the first thing I'm going to do is check out who produced this.
Yeah, right.
People don't buy records based on who the producer is. You know, they buy the records. So you learn after a while, you know, that it's not necessarily one thing you do. It depends on what a particular act brings into the studio. And if they fully confident and the songs are great and stuff like that, yeah, I may only be worrying about the sounds, you know, and just deciding when to call lunch. But then there are those instances in which, you know, there are interpersonal dynamic in the band and they're feeling a little bit of tension and frightfulness because they realize this is going to represent them, this document, and you have to hold their hands through the whole process in some sense.
For people who are going to come to the show on May 9th at the Peabody, which, by the way, is a magnificent concert hall, a terrific place to play, just give us a little tease for people thinking about buying a ticket. What are they
going to
see?
Well, they're going to see a show in two acts. We're going to address the entire canon from the first album to the last album. A lot of production, video and lights and all that other stuff. Surprise addition to the band because our keyboard players have been kind of like the drummers for Spinal Tap. You know, they keep exploding.
Right.
So we have a brand new keyboard phenom who will be playing with us. His name is Gil Asias. We're pretty excited about that. So, yeah, it'll be the old, the new, and everything in between.
Todd Rundgren, May 9th, Peabody here in St. Louis. Thank you very much, Todd.
Terrific. Thank you. We'll see you soon.
We got to get you a woman, and when we're through with you, we'll get me one, two.
That's got to be one of my favorite interviews in the last 10 years. Todd Rundgren. And that wraps up another J.C. Corcoran podcast here for the 22nd of April, 2021. Please tell your friends that we are here every morning, bright and early at 7 a.m. Monday through Friday, but you can listen whenever you want. We post at 7 a.m. And we thank you for being aboard. Have a great day. Talk to you again tomorrow morning here at jcontheline.com.
The J.C. Corcoran Podcast.
We're talking with Todd Rundgren. I want to go back to before the beginning, not just some kid who saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan and threw together a garage band and said, I think it would be fun to do this. I'm talking about when you really got serious about this and said to yourself, you know what? I really think I could do this. I think I want to make my living doing this stuff. Take me back to those days, Todd.
Well, it sounds very proactive, like I made that kind of decision, but it was more like by the time I got out of high school, I was unqualified to do anything else. I didn't have the grades to get into college. I hadn't really developed any other skill. I didn't take auto shop when I was in high school. All I had was essentially my guitar and, you know, whatever it is I could get out of the guitar. And I kind of got lucky because it didn't take me too long to get into a working band. And from that point on, it was just, you know, climbing up the ladder. That band was called Woody's Truck Stop in Philadelphia. And we were like a typical white blues band modeled after Paul Butterfield. And I didn't sing and I didn't write. All I did was play so-called blues guitar. And then the whole music scene changed, and the band decided that they wanted to be the Grateful Dead and go to the country and take acid and get their heads together, as they like to refer to it. And that's when I formed my own band called The Naz. That's probably when I got more serious, because I realized I had to write stuff, and I was singing backgrounds and stuff for the band. I didn't sing a lot of leads or anything, but that's when I started to really sort of expand as a musician outside of just playing guitar.
And one of the reasons I've always been drawn to you, and I think that explains a lot of your fan base, is that you're a boat rocker. I mean, you never just want to do anything normal or straight. You always want to put the Todd Rundgren twist on things. What was it about the music industry and what you were hearing coming out of the radio? And if you were in Philadelphia, you were getting a little better brand of radio than most people got across the country. So you were getting a little taste of a lot of different things that were out there. But what was it that, were you just dissatisfied? Did you find pop music just sort of boring? Or just sort of take me back to the mindset in those days.
Well, all of us got our inspiration from the Beatles. You know, the Beatles were an eclectic band. They started out covering other people's songs, and then they started to write their own material. And then, you know, after they started getting high and stuff, coming up with really weird hybrid of music, you know, once they got mentally liberated. And so growing up with that, you sort of figured that music is supposed to be evolutionary. You know, it's supposed to change all the time. You're supposed to pay homage to your influences, all whatever variety they may be. And the Beatles were a great repository of that, because they do anything from like old trad rock and that sort of bluesy stuff to English music hall to inventing, you know, whole new genres like psychedelic rock. So I grew up believing that that's what a real musician did. They kept absorbing influences, resynthesizing them, and you never did the same thing twice.
And this is very interesting, because while we're talking about the production aspect and just sort of the wild influences, still about 90% of Todd Rundgren's music really has an ever-presence of humanity in it. You know, things that all human beings should probably be concerned with. Love and friendship and looking for answers in life. So I guess the way that Beatles influence is, when it came right down to it, they were writing about people.
Well, yeah, the Beatles succeeded because they were ultimately relatable. They started out with extremely simple but identifiable themes like, I want to hold your hand. You know, something as simple and direct as that. And then they get to, like, you know, A Day in the Life, which is just like an epic, like some sort of epic mural painting or something like that. So they were always relatable in that sense. And unless you're like really kind of cynical about it, or you do it just because it's a job, it's always a reflection of your personal experience. I've always wanted to know about things, not simply read about them, but go out and experience them. So my music is a reflection of combination of my curiosity and the experiences I have relating to other people, but also trying to figure myself out. A lot of people sort of figure when they get out of school, that's when you stop learning. And you just kind of, utilize what you've learned for the rest of your life. But I've always actually learned more when I got out of school than I ever learned in school. And the music simply is kind of a document that reflects the stuff that I've learned.
Man, oh man, if I could high-five you on that one. You sound like you're crawling around inside my head, by the way, but that's maybe a conversation well, for another day.
It's funny how common my experience growing up in the 60s and 70s and stuff like that is with a lot of my peers. You know, we were all kind of rethinking everything. The world that we suddenly found ourselves in that seemed to be constantly at war, and the women's revolution and the black struggle and the drugs and all of that stuff. A lot of people in my generation, that was a generation of great upheaval and change, and we all kind of identified with it in a way.
Well, let's tap into that right there, because I've had similar conversations with a couple of guys like that, most notably Graham Nash. In the 1960s, you know, you had all these people running around in tie-dye and gauze shirts and bell-bottoms, and their hair was long, and everybody was rebellious, and that was the 60s, and now a good chunk of that population, they're all the ones listening to Rush Limbaugh and voted for Donald Trump. And not to get political about it, but what the hell happened? Because those people were supposed to change the world. We were going to change the world as kids. And instead, an alarming percentage of those people really did turn into their parents.
Well, you could look at, you know, these trends for a vast amount of the population as being just that, fads that they go through. You know, all the peace and love and all of that stuff. It's easier when you're young and you don't have kids of your own that you have to set an example for. A lot of that, you know, just settling down to a regular life sobers people up a bit. I've been fortunate because I never had to get a regular job, you know, because I actually had two jobs. I had record production as well as being a working musician. The record production always guaranteed me a good income, so I was always much more free in terms of making my music. And I think that's, you know, what happens to a lot of people, that just the realities of trying to survive economically and adapt to the change that is constantly happening. You know, sometimes people just give up and they say, okay, I'm just going to go with the flow. Now, having said that, without getting too political about it, I don't understand anybody who votes for Donald Trump. I don't want to sound like I'm identifying, because I'm definitely not. But I think people's so-called political beliefs proceed from how they see the world, and they try and find a politic that somehow adapts to that. And we just naturally, when we get older, get more insular and a little bit more selfish and protective and clannish and that sort of thing. It's a survival mechanism, I guess, and you have to sort of consciously resist it in a way. Dare I say, part of the appeal of my music is that it is constantly pushing against convention and trying to look at things in a different way or reevaluate things in a different light, just so you understand them a little bit better. It doesn't mean that people actually change just because they've had the revelation. Yeah. They can realize, you know, oh, geez, you know, what a mistake I've made, and I shouldn't be living this way. But it's too late to change. Yeah. So you just wind up continuing the old habits.
Like when you talk to baseball managers here in St. Louis, I had long conversations with Tony La Russa when he was managing the Cardinals. And he's like, this isn't about managing baseball. It's about managing people. So when you're working with Badfinger or Grand Funk or Meatloaf and producing all of this fabulous music for other people, is that applicable to the music business too, where you're not really managing music, you're managing people?
Well, you could say the producers have different approaches to what they do. Like when I first started out, I didn't really understand how much of like psychology and politics is involved in trying to get a project done. The musician's predicament may seem unique, but people always feel pressure in their job, and you don't realize that part of your job is to relieve that pressure, just to simply make them feel comfortable. and not distracted and to focus on what they're trying to accomplish. When I first started production, I didn't realize that that's what it was. I thought it was all sound. You know, you make everything sound great and you tell the band how they should play and that sort of thing. You know, that's what George Martin would have done. But George Martin didn't become the fifth Beatle without constantly trying to understand what it is they wanted and make it as easy as possible for them to get it. And so in latter years, I started to realize that, yeah, it's more about kind of managing the personalities involved. Yeah, you may be making a musical or technical contribution, but you're not trying to put your imprint on it. Whoever's name is on the front cover, they're the ones that have to live with the end result.
Yeah. You know?
Nobody says, you know, like, the first thing I'm going to do is check out who produced this.
Yeah, right.
People don't buy records based on who the producer is. You know, they buy the records. So you learn after a while, you know, that it's not necessarily one thing you do. It depends on what a particular act brings into the studio. And if they fully confident and the songs are great and stuff like that, yeah, I may only be worrying about the sounds, you know, and just deciding when to call lunch. But then there are those instances in which, you know, there are interpersonal dynamic in the band and they're feeling a little bit of tension and frightfulness because they realize this is going to represent them, this document, and you have to hold their hands through the whole process in some sense.
For people who are going to come to the show on May 9th at the Peabody, which, by the way, is a magnificent concert hall, a terrific place to play, just give us a little tease for people thinking about buying a ticket. What are they
going to
see?
Well, they're going to see a show in two acts. We're going to address the entire canon from the first album to the last album. A lot of production, video and lights and all that other stuff. Surprise addition to the band because our keyboard players have been kind of like the drummers for Spinal Tap. You know, they keep exploding.
Right.
So we have a brand new keyboard phenom we'll be playing with. His name is Gil Asias. We're pretty excited about that. So, yeah, it'll be the old, the new, and everything in between.
Todd Rundgren, May 9th, Peabody here in St. Louis. Thank you very much, Todd.
Terrific. Thank you. We'll see you soon.
J.C. Corcoran Podcast.